games. Elsewhere, the White Sox over the Twins 7-6. Now, the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. A slight chance of showers and storms this afternoon and evening. No severe weather is expected. Otherwise, a mostly cloudy day on tap today with a high near 81, an overnight low around 63. For tomorrow, sunny, cooler, and drier with a high near 74. For Friday, more sunshine with cool temperatures remaining in the low 70s. Looking ahead, dry and warmer for the holiday weekend. A beach hazard statement for threatening waves of 3 to 5 feet and dangerous currents is in place for Lake Michigan beaches through Friday evening. The normal high for this time of year is 81. The record high for this date is 100. That mark set in 1931. Sunset this evening at 8:34. Right now, 75. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
I am glad that I can welcome into our studios once again for his monthly visit to our program, Dr. Art Sear, who is with the faculty of Carthage College, professor of political economy and world business, a columnist whose work appears in papers all over the country, author of After the Cold War, someone who also appears regularly on WUWM up in Milwaukee. And we're so pleased that the morning show is also part of his itinerary. And there's a lot of different things to talk about today. So, Professor Art Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's always a pleasure.
Good to have you here.
It really is.
Glad we can have these. Glad we can have these conversations. You've written some very interesting columns over the last few weeks, as always. And one of them that I think is worth our exploring concerns the United States Supreme Court and the fact that the Supreme Court, on more than one occasion, has offered up what could probably be characterized in the minds of many some surprises. That is, it is a court that is typically described as now quite conservative, more conservative than it used to be, and yet it has offered up more than one decision that would not necessarily have been predicted by the conservatives or wished by the conservatives. So in other words, it is a more moderate body than it is commonly portrayed in mainstream media. So why don't we begin there with what, you know, is at the heart maybe kind of a misunderstanding by some of what the Supreme Court is or how it should function, and then a little bit about kind of its current state.
Yeah, well, that's actually a very big question. I think the heart of the matter to me is that it is one of three co-equal branches of government, along with Congress, of course, and the president and the executive, his or her executive branch. And it was designed that way. It is removed from the day-to-day fire and brimstone and Sturm und Drang and great emotion of our political system, which is nothing new, by the way, in our system. In many ways, things were more conflicted and more violent, certainly in our past. But the court provides a sort of anchor in the law, which we can all thank God or whomever we look to or whatever. It has remained that way from the beginning. And we're based on the common law system, very much a British legal tradition and approach, which contrasts certainly with the continent of Europe and parts of the rest of the world. Although the common law, as commerce grows, I think will become more and more important. To actually answer your question, the Supreme Court has issued a flurry of summer decisions, as traditionally they do. What impressed me in the column, and what I tried to communicate in the column, is that the court, and I credit them all, but particularly Chief Justice John Roberts, have been able to avoid a whole flurry of 5-4 decisions of the kind that make the news, and even on some controversial matters, have been 9-0 or 8-1. There was a lot of attention to the young woman who went in high school, was punished, sanctioned by school authorities for some of her obscene and angry comments online but off campus. And the Supreme Court, as they do very predictably, and we can all thank God for that, I say with particular emphasis, upheld the First Amendment and her freedom of speech, especially off campus. The two unanimous decisions that I really focused on were Fulton versus Philadelphia, where a Catholic Social Services agency was denied support by the city of Philadelphia because, thanks to their religious beliefs, they declined to accept same-sex couples as foster parents. The city of Philadelphia was upheld in court initially, but the Supreme Court came down on the side of the religious service organization, relying on the argument that equal protection of the law is important, and also no one suffered. There was no injury under the law because there were a multitude. I think they mentioned something like around 25 other social services agencies available in Philadelphia, which are secular in nature, and where same-sex couples will have the opportunity if they so choose. In a case that may prove to be far more important socially as well as economically, in my opinion, the very, very powerful NCAA, National Collegiate Athletic Association, was in effect ordered to let college athletes profit directly from their endorsement and other involvement in the commercial marketplace. That seems to me to be particularly important. It has particularly strong implications for professional football, which does not involve enormously greater sums than basketball or baseball. All pro sports involves big money, as everyone knows without me making the point. But it does, it has since the days of the great Commissioner Pete Rozelle back in the 1960s, it's been very much a powerful monopoly. Baseball has a very different farm system, as sports fans especially know. So I think the dynamics, the opportunity for talented young athletes, especially who might go on to the pros, the flexibility, the opportunity to make some money directly, it doesn't all accrue to Big Ten, especially in effect state-sponsored football schools and others that have where athletic programs really benefit, but the students who are doing the work do not. It's an important matter, and to me it goes well beyond the law involved. I hope I've been clear in making this point. Whenever I'm not clear, like I tell every students and everybody else, please let me know when I'm not clear. I don't want to be the last to know, but I hope that's a clear point. The economic implications of the NCAA decision are profound.
Right. So what do those two decisions say about the Supreme Court and kind of the way that the Supreme Court is operating right now?
It to me, it's reassuring because the media focuses in this case and in other cases and in lots of different cases in our political and social system and economy on great conflict. And again, opportunities for great emotional engagement of their listeners and viewers, given the dynamics of media today, especially. But it shows a real ability to work out consensus. A point I try to write about the court and our legal system fairly regularly because it is important and it's a good source of self-discipline for me because I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a constitutional law expert by any means.
So these two decisions were emphatic? I mean, they were not 5-4 decisions? I mean, is that part of
saying? Is that they were emphatic because they were basically uniform. They were uniform. Those were two unanimous decisions.
Unanimous.
And the schoolgirl, the young student decision, I believe, was 8-1. So they've been, despite the fact, as you highlight, as media representatives always do, whatever the medium, the fact that there is a left-right split on the court. Roberts especially has been able to work out consensus. And there his background is important. The court in our time has been dominated. This is not just my editorializing. People who spent their life in academia, in politics, as political activists, academics and activists to a significant degree are on the court, not always chosen because of their legal and judicial abilities per se. That has led to a situation where justices, like us professors, have a tendency to talk to ourselves and lecture others. Roberts has a background that involved a fairly long period of time in corporate law, which is by definition adversarial, and you have tremendous incentives, not just financial, but big money is involved, to work things out before you go to court. He also worked at a fairly young age in the Reagan White House. He had a staff position. He was working with line responsibilities in government, which to me is different from political activism and very different from academia. So I think that helped him develop skill sets. I'm sure that was one reason that the George W. Bush administration and President Bush nominated him in 2005, I think, when things were extremely acrimonious.
Right.
So it is reassuring.
I see what you're saying, that it's not even so much like what was decided in these two cases as much as the fact that, in a sense, left-leaning and right-leaning judges were able to come together and issue unanimous or nearly unanimous decisions.
It's both, really. The fact that it was unanimous makes the decision more powerful and more credible across the board. It's an environment that is highly politicized. I would argue it always has been, but intensity waxes and wanes. It's particularly intense now. With 2020 hindsight, one of President Trump's most telling arguments during his campaign from the start is it looks like the next president will have a chance to nominate Supreme Court justices, and I assure you I will not follow the liberal course. And in fact, he lived up to that promise very effectively. And the three justices he appointed are justices all with conservative credentials politically, but have proven not to be ideologues on the court.
I do remember in your column, which really is interesting, and I hope people will seek it out to look at it if they haven't already, is you cite a case from several decades ago with Chief Justice Earl Warren, who you talk about him working behind the scenes for an exceptionally important case to try to achieve some level of consensus before they actually rendered their decision, and then they rendered something within the civil rights era, but I'm forgetting now exactly the specific case. But the fact that Earl Warren also seemed to believe that, particularly in this particular case, it was important for the case to speak with as uniform and strong a voice as humanly possible.
That was the famous Brown versus Board of Education.
Course. Yes.
Board of Education, which reversed an 1890s decision which had confirmed racial segregation. It was a decision for racial integration. Earl Warren, a career politician, he'd been governor of California. Eisenhower named him to the court in 1953, one of his first decisions, and one of the first of a number of Supreme Court justices that Ike had the opportunity to nominate. It was a political payoff in part. Earl Warren had been the vice presidential Republican nominee in 1944 with Tom Dewey. He had hopes of being president himself, and he hoped that a brokered convention in 1952, a stalemate between Robert Taft, the front runner at the time, believe it or not, and Eisenhower, who was the underdog, would lead to his being nominated. There was a good chance of that. Except an increasingly famous, notorious, controversial freshman senator by the name of Richard Nixon went behind Warren's back and lined up enough delegates to throw not the nomination but a technical motion on the convention floor to Ike. I think that's complicated enough.
Wow.
But
I did not know that.
Politics was involved. It's always involved. Warren, the first decision on the docket for that year was Brown versus Board, which was 5-4. Earl Warren postponed it and spent a year getting to know his fellow justices and spending a lot of time, which is always hard for impatient Americans especially to do when we want to get on to practical things. But it was a 9-0 decision. And given the profound nature of the decision and how difficult the Civil Rights Revolution, which was already emerging in the 50s, in the 40s actually, soon after the war. The timing was brilliant, and he was ideal in that role, again with hindsight, but it made him very, very controversial. And that Supreme Court, which had a profound impact on our life, positive in my view, was far more controversial than the court today.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting, and it shows that this stuff isn't dull.
Right.
I think sometimes people on both sides of the spectrum who are most intensely involved emotionally and incensed don't pay much attention to the details. They're just interested in their cause. But actually getting into the details of legal and judicial processes can be really interesting.
To quote Captain Kirk from Star Trek, it's important that you think with your mind and not with your glands, which he said at some
that's
point
good
in, some,
to know.
In some episode
when yeah, that's
somebody
not,
was getting overheated. And
this is
with,
the William Shatner, Captain
yes,
Kirk?
Right,
okay,
yes.
Not his more plausible successor? Well, right. I'll use that. Thank you. That's not what I associate with his on-screen or off-screen personality.
Yeah, he was calming down yeah. Dr. McCoy about something or other. So.
And that's what the law does. But he didn't have to calm down Mr. Spock.
Right.
Who I would have figured would say something like that.
Exactly. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today on The Morning Show with Dr. Art Sear from the faculty of Carthage College, and we are talking about a number of different issues and concerns that he has touched on in some of his most recent columns. You write about President Biden's recent trip to Europe, and one of the points you make is that it is a kind of a welcome return to customary U.S. leadership in the world scene in general, and also with NATO, of course. President Biden having a different attitude about NATO than his predecessor, at least to some extent, did. But mostly you write about the endurance of NATO and the fact that it has been such a significant force for stability in the world, and that it has a range of missions that has allowed it or caused it to remain very, very relevant over all of these years. Tell us why you think it's really important for Americans to understand the nature of NATO and its significance, and in particular, its enduring significance.
I think, probably is the most durable military alliance in history at this point, at least in modern history. The Economist, NATO's 70th anniversary, 2019, The Economist had a very fine in-depth, the weekly publication based in Britain I'm referring to, the average alliance during the Napoleonic era, which went on for a couple decades, was only about 5 years. NATO has proven to be remarkably durable. It was set up in 1949 to counter what was clearly Soviet expansionism, the Berlin blockade, Stalin's effort to isolate and starve out West Berlin, which was far in the East German communist sector in occupied Europe, had occurred the year before. By 47, 48, the Cold War had really emerged in Europe. So in 48, planners really started knuckling down to develop this alliance. The British in this area, as in so many others, served as extremely important catalysts and mediators as well as initiators. And they brought the U.S. and Canada, please don't forget, into this firm alliance with the continent of Europe. The Soviets responded with the Warsaw Pact, which is now long gone. It disappeared with the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc in 89-90. But NATO endures, and there's a big debate about whether it should continue. Now, as you alluded, President Trump was a major critic, a very vocal critic of NATO. My own opinion is that he was primarily talk in the White House. It's a major accomplishment for anyone to get elected president of the United States, but once he was there, he did not actually do much beyond a lot of verbal disruption and constant personnel changes. You're quite right. He was very vocal in criticizing NATO. But he never proposed withdrawing from that organization or from the UN. He didn't actually do much. My own opinion is that had he achieved a second term, he might well have done a lot. I think the killing of General Soleimani, the Iran military head, which our government carried out by drone, I think that was totally wrong morally. It was stupid policy, and I think we might well have seen more of that if he got a second term. So I'm not minimizing, I'm not a supporter of his, and on NPR especially, I want to emphasize that I think he was inimical in many ways, but he didn't actually do much. And NATO has always had frictions, and his complaint that the Europeans should do more has been there almost from the beginning. It was set up in 49. In 1952, NATO across the board, meeting in Lisbon, Portugal, a crucial linchpin of the alliance, given the nature of the conflict with the Soviet Union and their allies. They agreed on force goals that they proceeded not to meet, except for the British and us. And today it's the British, the Poles, and us, I think, that meet our commitments. So these frictions are nothing new. President Trump unfortunately highlighted them, but he also let off a lot of steam that had been building up within the American electorate. So I think it's de minimis. He made a lot of European leaders upset, and Joe Biden in many ways is ideal to reassure critics of his predecessor both at home and abroad.
One of my favorite lines in that column was, Donald Trump's destructiveness was mainly rhetorical.
I thought you'd like that.
I think that's a good turn of phrase. I mean, I suppose some people could argue the importance of one's rhetoric, that kind of destructiveness is not just theoretical, but I think your point is very well made. I happen to agree with it completely.
Oh, good. So, well, I'm glad about that.
Let's talk for a moment about the president of South Korea, President Moon Jae-in. Someone who was, I believe, sworn into office back in 2017.
Yes.
And unlike, for instance, former President Donald Trump, President Moon Jae-in seems to specialize in being very much kind of under the radar and doing quiet, significant work, not for the sake of generating headlines and so on or stirring waters, but just working behind the scenes in some really significant ways that are often very much missed. Tell us more about your impressions of the South Korean leader in this respect, and why he is commanding your respect among others.
Yes, I certainly am a supporter of his. Thank you. Much more important is he's not particularly popular at home. And that tends to be the case among Korean leaders since the nation moved from very harsh, extreme military dictatorship, that's no exaggeration, to phenomenally effective and functioning representative democracy. It's not a deferential culture in the same way that Japan, for instance, and other parts of Asia are. That's a great generalization, but I do believe it's true, and I'm prepared to defend that. I think it's one reason why our alliance, I believe the South Koreans are particularly important and vital allies of ours in that part of the world. He has a 5-year term, according to current rules, and that means he's pressed for time to try to work out an accommodation with the North. My impression is South Korean people have a rather schizophrenic attitude or divided attitude toward the North. Korea does not have a long history of division or fragmentation, in contrast to Germany, for instance, and, by the way, Vietnam. They had distinctive regions, but from ancient times there was a sense of unity, partly because they were standing off both China and Japan quite effectively for about 1,000 years. People long for reunification, but understandably North Korea, and especially the bizarre leader, are quite controversial. And I think part of Moon's unpopularity is, one, he hasn't been able to work out any real detente with the North or any even very preliminary collaboration with the North. And he's also been extending himself to try to work things out. He may yet succeed in a major breakthrough, but I think that is part of the unhappiness with his leadership. I believe he's a very courageous and effective leader behind the scenes. While President Trump was first threatening and denouncing North Korea and referring to Little Rocket Man and publicly insulting the regime and the leader, Moon was working behind the scenes. And then after the Singapore summit, I think, after Trump's second meeting with the North Korean dictator, he said, "I've fallen in love." I mean, the whole thing was absurd and bizarre, Moon quietly was working to get the two eccentric leaders together and also trying to work out the details of collaboration. They are cooperating in the area of athletics, and I think he'll be able to make more progress. The 2018 Winter Olympics, for instance, involved both sides in South Korea. And he's been up north at least once for a major public athletic event.
Well, and I mean, given the recent history of the two nations, that the significance of that gesture probably shouldn't be understated. I mean, that's huge for a South Korean leader to meet with a North Korean leader, even if it's within the arena of athletics, isn't it?
Yeah. You emphasize the real importance of rhetoric, and you're right about the real importance of gestures and activities and collaboration that's outside the realm of politics and national security. During the height of the Cold War, from the start of his administration, President Eisenhower emphasized cooperation in sports as well as culture and science. That's why we had the Bolshoi Ballet in New York, and Leonard Bernstein, and Louis Armstrong, and other greats in the music and theatrical world in Moscow and the Soviet Union. And Moon has been trying to, I believe, engineer things along that line, and it works.
Interesting.
It is interesting, and it's important. He's personally very admirable. He's a courageous man from a very young age. He was a civil rights and human rights activist, a public critic of the Park Chung-hee dictatorship, which was an extremely dangerous thing to do. When he was very young, he was imprisoned for that reason. He became a human rights lawyer. All young Korean males are subject to military service, but he took advantage of the opportunity to become an officer, special forces officer. He saw action in the DMZ. Despite the ceasefire, it's been a very hot, dangerous area regularly since 1953. He's a man who's accomplished a lot, is quite dedicated, and to me, he really personifies not only the great strengths of the population as a whole, but also the commitment to democracy.
I wanted to highlight another of your recent columns, which I initially misunderstood. It began with a story out of Belarus and the taking down, not by crash landing, but you know, the forcing down of a plane that carried a prominent political dissident, and of course it was an incident that attracted a huge amount of attention, and I kind of thought that's what that column was going to be about, and it actually really wasn't about that at all, except to highlight the fact that, again, there is a tendency to gravitate towards those kind of flamboyant and spectacular headlines about dramatic or melodramatic incidents, and then completely miss much bigger stories that reside just beneath the surface, and then you touch on kind of a plethora of different issues that are kind of emblematic of that. So could you just say a word about what prompted you to craft this interesting column?
Well, it was headline news, and I think it's important, at least to some extent, to reflect current events and current headline interests if you're going to be successful in writing a general interest opinion column. Belarus is more than Russia, a throwback to the earlier totalitarian days of the 20th century. They do have elections, but they're outrageously rigged. They've had the same president for decades, and he very arrogantly orchestrated intercepted an aircraft that was traversing their airspace between two very distant destinations to arrest a young activist. It was very counterproductive in terms of the regime in this day and age. And President Trump, to his credit, made the point to Putin, the there's a very close alliance between Belarus and Russia, an alliance very much of necessity today, that nothing better happen to him in prison. Belarus, which has a very weak economy, as does Russia, has immediately been sanctioned by the European Union. Commercial airliners of all sorts were directly encouraged by governments they rely on not to fly to Belarus, but they also did it on their own, given the commercial and transportation integration of the world today. It was just a very dumb move to do this. So Belarus has been sanctioned, and I think the negative consequences will continue to accrue. Behavior that was pretty routine, especially before World War II, and to a significant degree during the Cold War, has become quite unacceptable today. There is a film that did not do very well at the box office, but is a great movie, called The Courier, based on fact about and it's a fine film as well. It's readily available, again, thanks to the world we live in, about a British businessman who very courageously was recruited by a combination of British intelligence and our CIA to collect information, especially from Oleg Penkovsky, who was another hero, an enormously important spy for the West during the tensest times of the Cold War. This businessman was imprisoned. He almost got out, but the Soviets finally arrested him just before he would have left the country, and he suffered just incredibly in the Soviet prison system. The film is kind of schizophrenic. It's partly fascinating, sometimes entertaining drama at the beginning about the interplay between the Brits and the Americans, and how this fellow, who's just a standard stand-up British businessman, was doing his best to be helpful to his country, played hell with his family life, in particular his relations with his wife. But then the second half is just this horrific presentation, graphic and realistic, of the Soviet prison system. They just can't operate that way today. Mm-hmm. You know, the poor fellow disappeared, in effect. He did live. He was finally released in a spy, a classic spy exchange. But we live in far better times today.
Mm. So I think
Putin started out in the KGB. I'm sure he longs for the good old days, but not even he can behave that way today.
Mm. So that's really the point of this story, is not we live in this horrible world where these kind of things keep happening, but it's your point is that we live in a world in which this, which once upon a time would have passed almost without notice, now generates a level of outrage that once upon the time we would not have seen.
That's what I was struggling to say, I think. Thank you. Yeah. And Lukashenko he's not going to leave tomorrow, but he's literally a throwback to the really terrible era of the 20th century and totalitarian dictatorships that for a time dominated much of the world and for a time controlled some of the most powerful and economically strong nations in the world. And those days are gone completely. Mm-hmm. Lukashenko is what Ronald Reagan would refer to as a two-bit, tin-horn dictator running a very shabby, fragile country, exploiting his people. He's still there, but it's not going to last. That's not the way the world is moving, thank God. In the 20th century, it could have. And we must all keep that in mind.
Yeah. I did want to spend a couple of minutes at least talking about political events in Israel with the ouster of Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been, I think his current term is for something like 12 years, and I think he had an earlier term back in the 1990s, but he's someone who's been kind of a polarizing figure and increasingly controversial, and I think facing an array of corruption charges. I don't know a whole lot about that, but he was in effect recently ousted from office thanks to a number of his political rivals coming together to form what was perhaps a somewhat fragile, but nevertheless a coalition government that was able then to, in effect, remove him from office. First of all, I wonder if you can, what you want to tell us about Benjamin Netanyahu and why he has been the controversial figure that he is, and also if you think there is significance on the world scene to his removal from office.
Yes, it is significant. He personifies, and has to me for some time, the fact that Israel has been moving to the right, partly because of the perennial and in some ways growing conflict with Arab and Islamic populations in the immediate region, and partly because there's been a huge influx since the 70s of immigrants from what was then the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, partly because of U.S. pressure that's had some influence on even the Soviet regime on human rights grounds, and they part of the world that has a very strong history of anti-Semitism. Simply let people go. Those Jewish immigrants to Israel, in contrast to those from Western Europe and the U.S., tend to be much more conservative in their politics. So the Likud party, a conservative approach, a hardline approach to dealing with the populations in the region, has become dominant in Israel. At the same time, it's a multi-party system. They spend an awful lot of time arguing and bickering in public, and that's the nature of democracy. Theirs is much more fractious than others, it's fair to say. Netanyahu is undeniably a political genius. As you indicate, he's been around for a long, long time. There was a general consensus building that it was time to go. Also, so he has been indicted. He and his wife are facing very serious criminal accusations in the system. The wheels of justice grind slowly when they work right, but they have been grinding, and that was looming over him. Given that and the fact that over time, inevitably, even successful politicians develop enemies and create frictions, and certainly Netanyahu has done that, he became more and more isolated. So a coalition, in effect, has been formed. He was not able to form a government, partly because of the legal problems that I mentioned. The new coalition won't represent any major departures in policy, but for the first time, one of the three parties involved is an Arab party. Arabs are represented in Israel. They are a growing population in Israel, as they are in the region, unlike the Jewish population. That's a reality that I think will force moderation over time on both sides, and already has, in my opinion. But that's a real breakthrough. In contrast to the occupied territories, where the Israeli government behaves in ways that I think are wrong, within the borders of Israel, minorities have rights and representation, and it's extremely significant. More important, I think, even the legal process unfolding against Netanyahu, is how the Arab minority is doing in parliament and how the dynamics unfold in the government. But it's a new day. It was certainly time for Netanyahu to go. It's not just my opinion. And Americans should all pay close attention. The only other point I'd make, and here I'll be brief for a change, often progress has been greatest in the Middle East when frictions between the U.S. and Israel have been high. So Americans should not be, Americans who are pro-Israel, and that's the overwhelming majority of us, Americans shouldn't be too concerned if there are diplomatic and political frictions between Washington and the government in Israel.
I just can't let you be that brief. I'm so intrigued by that point. What do you think is the reason why progress would be made on the heels of friction between the United States and Israel? I mean, what do you think the dynamic is that causes that?
Because we benefit and they benefit when there is regional peace and stability. the U.S. uniquely has the power in the current situation. In the Cold War, we were in competition with the Soviets, but we have the power uniquely to influence events in the region. And three presidents, in my mind, really stand out. Eisenhower, during the Suez Crisis of 56, in a moment of insanity, the governments of Israel, Britain, and France secretly decided on an old-fashioned, old-time gunboat diplomacy imperialist move. The new extremist nationalist regime in Egypt had taken over the Suez Canal, which was built and run by an international company dominated by the British. They took it over, which was illegal. The British and French, their paratroopers, retook in a spectacular operation. They retook the canal at the same time that Israeli armor started rolling across the Sinai Peninsula. Eisenhower was outraged, rightly, that we hadn't been consulted. He thought the move was strategically and politically stupid as well as wrong. We found ourselves allied with the Soviet Union and the UN, and we forced them to withdraw. Governments in all three countries fell. We have not faced anything that serious. I emphasize, because we worry so much, we have not faced anything that serious since 56. It provided the Soviets an opportunity to develop strong alliances with Arab states. And as I said, throughout the Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviets were basically in competition in the Mideast, and we were often on the losing end post-Eisenhower. Jimmy Carter, in 1978, I believe, got the Egyptians and the Israelis together to work out a peace agreement at Camp David, showing his incredible determination as well as acute intelligence. When he was really successful, Carter was phenomenally successful. And that peace agreement has held. It was so impressive in the immediate region that Jordan, some years later, also signed a peace treaty with Israel. That was the other example of great presidential leadership. And President George H.W. Bush and his phenomenal Secretary of State, James Baker, a little closer to our time than many of our listeners will recall, they orchestrated this incredible international alliance to drive Iraq out of Kuwait after Saddam Hussein arrogantly invaded and occupied Kuwait in 1990. The Gulf War of early 1991 was an extraordinary success, just remarkable, in the much more fluid post-Cold War environment. Great testament to American leadership when we're doing things right. But they didn't stop there. Bush and Baker proceeded to a very aggressive diplomatic offensive that led to major international conferences in which the Russians participated in Madrid, and then in Oslo. The whole process took so long that Bill Clinton was in office when the Oslo Accords were signed, and Bill, of course, could take the credit and preach about world. But it was Bush and Baker, like Carter and like Ike, less dramatically, who had really built tremendous positive progress in the Mideast. We had no competitor. We were in a dominant position after the Oslo Accords were signed, creating a somewhat independent Palestinian entity that is currently a source of friction and controversy and a lot of heartache, but it was progress. Since that first Bush administration, in my opinion, we basically frittered away our advantage. I must admit grudgingly that Trump carried the peace process further by getting, I believe, two of the very small emirates to recognize Israel. That's no mean achievement. But at the same time, he moved our embassy to Jerusalem, getting nothing in return from the Israelis. I don't think he demonstrated the kind of leadership that these other presidents did. But it's the opportunity is there if we have a president who's willing to undertake the effort. But it is excruciating, even if you're a high-energy, highly intelligent national leader. Baker went to the Middle East six times after the Desert Storm victory, just in a period of about 3 months, dealing with some of the most difficult people in the world on some of the most vexing issues. You know, it ain't easy, but I think the opportunity is there especially there's no Soviet Union anymore. We have let Russia take the initiative, but the opportunity is still there, even though Putin has demonstrated phenomenal effectiveness in dealing with Israel as well as Turkey and the Arab states. Mm-hmm.